The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Surviving Syria's civil war today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The war in Syria has left the city of Aleppo in ruins, but it has not broken the spirit of those who stayed.
They're human beings. They breathe like us. They love like us. They want to one day do something that's very similar to what you want to do.
Plus, hanging out with the arms dealers who supply weapons to ISIS.
They were listening into a walkie-talkie frequency used by ISIS and heard them talking about kebab and salad. And I was like, what is going on? Is this a lunch order? And they said, no, this is some kind of a code for weapons.
Also, what happened when female lawmakers in New Zealand's parliament tried to speak out about rape.
As a victim of sexual violence...
Order, the member will leave the chamber.
Those stories and more today on The World. We start today's show with a pretty extraordinary glimpse inside the war-torn Syrian city of Aleppo. Earlier today, I reached Rami Jarrah, who is in Aleppo. Jarrah himself is Syrian, originally from Damascus. He fled in 2011, moved first to Egypt, then Turkey. That's where he and some friends founded a citizen media project called ANA Press. Jarrah recently made his way back into Syria and into rebel-dominated Aleppo, where he's found violence and sadness, but also a warmth and hospitality that's taken him by surprise. Jarrah told me about a gentleman he met in Aleppo's old city, standing beside an ancient doorway.
There is a man who used to have a tailor. Basically, he was a tailor, and his shop was destroyed by an airstrike. The man stands there every day, guarding that location because it's become basically debris, rubble under him. And he stands there because he worries that one day this land his father passed on to him, this will be taken from him. I've seen this man every time I've gone to the old city, and it's as if he's stuck in the past. And he says he refuses to fight, and the only thing that he's doing is that he's protecting his land.
With your citizen media project, ANA Press, you find yourself often going out to scenes where people are just frantic to find their loved ones who are often buried beneath rubble. Tell us about one incident just a few days ago involving a man searching for his children.
This was in the old city of Aleppo. There was a man that was panicking and saying, where's my son? Where's my children? My son Hassan. His children had been actually blown to pieces. They weren't under the rubble. They'd been actually hit directly by the missile itself. And in fact, his wife had also been killed in the attack. And we found that out yesterday when we visited them again.
So Rami, I mean, this man has lost basically his immediate family. How does he pick up and move on, especially in Aleppo, a city we know is under siege?
He's still in shock and he was furious. The man was continuously shouting, saying that ISIS are not here. Why has this happened to us? He grabbed his other son. And he was shaking his son, shaking him around, saying, do you want to kill him as well? It was just frantic. And I don't know how they cope.
You're also posing vignettes, little portraits of Aleppo residents you meet on your Facebook page. It's kind of like Humans of New York, but it's Humans of Aleppo. These are the Syrians you were just talking about who are trying to stay put and retain their lives, their humanity. Who actually impresses you? Who do you choose to profile?
You know, they're human beings. They breathe like us. They love like us. They want to one day do something that's very similar to what you want to do. They're really just normal human beings who are caught in a conflict. And I think if you place this sort of environment over any human being in any country or any situation, there would be side effects similar to the ones that we're seeing in Syria.
I mean, it's got to be said, Rami, that you're not an impartial observer.
Yes. Yes, definitely. If I'm to be totally honest, journalism in my situation is for the sake of activism. And as a media activist, I think what I'm aiming to do is to actually create that opposition information to the what's being amplified by the Syrian regime and its counterparts. It might sound like, you know, I'll say anything to oppose the Syrian regime. I hope that the principles of activism are enough proof that that's not going to be the case. As activists, what we were looking for in Syria is freedom of expression and the ability for people basically to choose who will lead them.
So when you go to a place like Aleppo, how do you feel about your own security?
It is something to worry about. ISIS do have hidden cells. I'm already not in their good books. We have a journalist that works with us that was kidnapped. This was in October 2013, and we haven't seen him since. There aren't any foreign journalists, totally understood. It's very dangerous for foreigners to be here. I'm a Syrian. It's easier for me. It's dangerous, but it's important.
Is what you're seeing in Aleppo and the kind of life you're leading there, is it changing you?
It's definitely changing me. I'm not a believer at all. However, I understand why people require in these situations something to believe in and something to have hope in. Someone was asking me the other day that are there shelters in Aleppo and are people using them? It was a research group. And I said, well, if there was thousands of shelters, or let's say a shelter under every single building, I don't think the people would go to them. Because this war has gone on for long enough for people to get used to the situation. I worry that I will get used to seeing the bloodshed. I worry about that.
Rami Jara is a co-founder of the citizen media project ANA Press. We've been speaking with him in Aleppo. Rami, thank you very much. Stay safe.
Thank you for having me, Marco. Thank you.
Dozens of nations are opposed to ISIS, so you'd think the group's military strength would be declining. But apparently ISIS is still able to easily get hold of arms and ammunition. The Financial Times has just published an investigation into the ISIS munitions trail.
It's all about the money. It's all for the dollar.
That's Erica Solomon, the lead reporter on the story for the FT. She says that because ISIS has money, it can simply exploit the black markets in the region.
What the arms dealers told us, because we were, of course, interviewing them from outside of Syria, was that basically they do a lot of their communicating by WhatsApp, actually. So because they're sort of
WhatsApp, the smartphone app.
Yes, it's like it's a mobile texting app. It's free. People love it in this part of the world. They seem to think it's somewhat secure, although I don't really know if that's borne out by the facts. But in any case, people just WhatsApp each other. So you'll have an arms dealer, say, in eastern Syria where ISIS is in control, WhatsApp his friend in northwestern Syria where the rebels are in control, or in the south where regime forces are in control. And they will, you know, negotiate their deals and agree on a network of smugglers to get the supplies to them. And the technology plays a big role in how they manage to get this done.
Yeah, and just good old-fashioned kind of coding for, you know, I need a rocket. They'll ask for a kebab. How would you actually kind of, how quickly would that resupply actually come?
So dealers are actually always buying, essentially, is what we were told. They're just always looking out for a deal. In fact, ISIS actually has like a price list, as we were told, of the top type of bullets that they're always in need of, like Kalashnikovs, certain type of anti-aircraft guns. If a dealer can find those bullets, he pretty much has license to just buy, as long as he can get it for the price ISIS says they're willing to pay, which usually they calculate as the going market rate in the region. So these guys will be buying those bullets, and local centers, as they call them, which are connected to the ISIS leadership, coordinate between the battlefront and dealers nearby who maybe are bringing in supplies. They'll talk on walkie-talkie, say, to military commanders and use code. Like you said, kebab was one that I actually heard when I was with Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga forces on the border. They were listening into a walkie-talkie frequency used by ISIS and heard them talking about kebab and salad. And I was like, what is going on? Is this a lunch order? And they said, no, this is some kind of a code for weapons. And I actually asked fighters who had fought for ISIS, and they said, yeah, salad would probably be code for ammunition because it's mixed like salad. And it changes every month. It changes from region to region, but they use this code. And what Iraqi security officials told us is that they find that within 24 hours, ISIS can fulfill the request of any battlefront in the region that they control.
Wow, 24 hours. That's incredible.
Yeah, that's pretty fast. They told me that they would like to know how they did it so they could use the same method.
Erica, what about explosives? I mean, ISIS is famous for suicide bombings and improvised explosive devices. Where does it get the raw materials for those?
As one official put it to me, put your finger on a map and probably something came from there. I mean, literally all over the world, you can find some piece of equipment that ISIS used to make a bomb out of. And they can use laptops, mobile phones. They use chemicals, which are commonly used in devices and hard to monitor, like things like aluminum oxide, as well as fertilizer, which is used for farming. And so all of these things, they just bring them in as much as they can over the border from Turkey, most of all, and secondly, from Lebanon and Iraq.
Erica Solomon, lead reporter for the Financial Times investigation into how ISIS is getting its arms and ammunition these days. Erica Solomon joined me from Beirut. Thank you very much, Erica.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan have announced that they will donate 99% of their Facebook shares, which is currently valued at $45 billion, to a new charitable foundation, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. It's a gift to celebrate the birth of their first child, a girl named Max. We want to spend a few minutes on this because it seems like a good thing, a generous and selfless thing, but philanthropy is complicated. William Mosley is a professor of geography at McAllister College, and he's been writing at Al Jazeera English about the dark alliance of global philanthropy and capitalism. Thanks for being with us. You write that the time has come for clean philanthropy. So lay out the problem for us. Why is philanthropy dirty right now, in your view?
Many of the foundations that support development get their revenue from endowments that are invested in markets that may be generating the very poverty that development organizations are trying to address, or the environmental problems that foundations are hoping to address in their work. And so there's this kind of tension between the way endowment monies are invested and the good works that foundations hope to do with that money.
Maybe you can give us one clear, specific example of this conflict of interest you're talking about.
Well, the Gates Foundation, for example, has come out strong in favor of addressing the challenge of global climate change. Yet they have $1.4 billion invested in the conventional or fossil fuel industry. So while they're doing good works, the way their endowment is invested is also perpetuating the problem.
Yeah, and as a disclaimer, I should say here that we, the world, receive grants from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and work with other philanthropic groups. What are the best practices in philanthropy that currently are not being employed?
Well, I think historically we talked about socially responsible investing. So, for example, a foundation or a university might make a decision not to invest in the fossil fuel industry. Increasingly, people in the financial world and the socially responsible financial world talked about impact investing. In this case, rather than just not investing in the fossil fuel industry, you may decide to invest in wind power. Increasingly, it's becoming clear over the long run that environmentally responsible, socially responsible investments actually do better, and that's contrary to the conventional wisdom.
Who is engaging in what you would consider clean philanthropy today, and how do you know it is clean?
I think increasingly the divestment movement amongst universities in the U.S. and Europe is picking up steam. We've seen large institutions make pledges to divest from the fossil fuel industry. Stanford University comes to mind. It's wonderful that they're providing funds for good work, but if they really want to bring about change, they also have to think about, you know, the businesses they run, the enterprises that are generating their wealth, and work on change there as well.
William Mosley at McAllister College has been writing about the dark alliance of global philanthropy and capitalism. Are you hopeful that things will change?
Well, the hour is upon us with the climate change summit to address these issues with the recent UN Sustainable Development Goals. And I'm an optimist by nature, so yes, I hope things will get better.
We'll have more on that UN climate conference later in the show, and we'll look at China's pledge to bring down coal emissions 60% by 2020. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Vegetarians, beware. Our next story is about a niche market that's developing to better serve America's estimated 2.5 million Muslims. I'm talking about halal meat. The World's Monica Campbell reports from Livingston, California.
Adam Musa found what he was looking for here in Livingston, California, a small rural city about 2 hours from San Francisco.
Myself and my wife, we were really hungry. You know, we wanted some meat.
Musa is from the Bronx, grew up with Catholic Latino parents, but later turned to Islam.
I'm a convert, or like to say revert, you know.
He follows the faith and eats halal.
It means permissible.
And when it comes to meat,
to make it halal, we have to treat the animal with utmost kindness and mercy, because this animal was put here by God.
For Musa, finding halal meat when he moved to rural California wasn't easy, until he heard about this small farm.
So one day I came to the slaughterhouse here and I saw how he did it, And, you know, that was my first order of steaks was right there.
He ordered straight from Shawali Mayer, who's run this slaughterhouse since 2000.
I'm from Afghanistan. I came in 1983.
He was 16, and his family, Mujahideen fighters, fought the Soviet-backed government. Mayer eventually had to escape, so he left, walked out of Afghanistan, through Iran and up to Europe. And then he was allowed to come to the U.S.
I used to work at the grocery store, you know, in Bay Area, you know, get a minimum wage of $2.75 an hour, you know.
When you first got here?
When I first got here. And we just saved the money and I worked hard, you know.
His family bought this land. Dry, flat, slightly hilly. It reminds Mayer of Afghanistan. And it's where he shows me the halal process. Today, it's all about lambs.
This is about 15, 20 lambs right here in the little room right here.
One by one, the lambs head into a narrow pen, facing northeast toward Mecca. Hussein, a butcher from Pakistan, takes it from here. It's a messy process. This is a slaughterhouse, after all. But there's a prayer.
Bismillahi Allahu Akbar.
God is great. And then things move very quickly and precisely. Mayer says the idea is for the animal to suffer as little as possible. The blood also drains quickly and fully. You're not going to see a rare, bloody, halal piece of meat ever. And soon, the animal is off to the meat locker. The process repeats with the knife sharpened every time. Only knives used here. Some halal slaughterhouses, bigger ones usually, stun animals before they're cut. Some Muslims accept that, but not Mayer. He says he can't electrocute anything.
I've been shocked by Russians before, electricity.
In Afghanistan, tortured for information during the war in the 80s.
I know when I see an animal getting shocked, I feel those shocks. I feel that pain.
So Mayer keeps it simple. His slaughterhouse is only about the size of a large classroom. It's also a process that's pretty similar to prepping kosher meat. There are differences, of course. With kosher, for example, only a rabbi can bless the animal, and usually only the first and last animal get blessed. With halal, any Muslim can do the job, and every animal gets blessed. And some Jews will eat halal, and some Muslims will eat kosher. It's a personal choice. Mayer then shows me the meat locker. Demand is growing, just like America's Muslim community.
You can see there's over 400 lambs in here. And by Friday, they give another order. This is gone. It's consumed completely.
Mayer has non-Muslim customers, too. He provides lambs for Easter. And his biggest customer?
My biggest customer, I tell you right now, is a Mexican restaurant.
He says the owner just likes the flavor of the meat. So halal tacos, two cultures in one, and why not? For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, Livingston, California.
Of course, you'll need a spritz of lime to go with those halal tacos, right? Or would that be lemon? Moira Lavelle explains.
I have a friend who has this great story of sitting with friends in Chile, trying desperately to explain that he wanted a lime in his soda, not a lemon. My friend is pretty fluent in Spanish, so he couldn't understand why there was a miscommunication, until, eventually, the exasperated Chileans told him they don't eat those unripe lemons. Apparently, limes aren't really a thing in Chile.
Well, the word for lemon is limón, as it is in most other varieties of Spanish. The word for lime doesn't exist, really.
This is Dr. Scott Sadowski, a professor of linguistics at Universidad de la Frontera in Temuco, Chile.
And that's due to the fact that there really is nothing like a lime here. Every once in a while, someone will download a recipe from the internet, and you might see it translated as lima, which is more or less a literal translation from English. And people will normally shrug and just use lemons.
This was a surprise to me, but I don't speak Spanish, and I wanted to double-check, so I called another linguist, Dr. Terrell Morgan, a professor of Hispanic linguistics at The Ohio State University. And he had a story about the first time his wife, originally from Spain, heard an advertisement for a soda that was lima limón, that is, lime lemon flavored.
She was taken aback and just assumed that it was direct translation from English, because for her, what we have called limes here in the United States, she would just call them limones verdes.
Limones verdes means green lemons. Turns out, almost everywhere in the Spanish-speaking world, there is a different word for lime. As you heard, Spaniards say limones verdes, Mexicans go for limón or maybe lima, and Chileans say nothing at all. And what about the famous capital of Peru, Lima? It turns out it has nothing to do with limes. It takes its name from an oracle, or Limac, that used to live in the area. But what surprised both me and linguist Terrell Morgan was that some Spanish speakers actually switch definitions. And what we think of as lemons, they call limes.
A Bolivian and an Ecuadorian and a Venezuelan and a Salvadoran all said to me that in their experience, limones are sour and green and smaller than our lemons. And that Lima for them is a larger fruit that's sweet and yellow.
Confused? This all makes sense when you consider that lemons and limes are not native to any Spanish-speaking country, or even their own species of fruit. I talked to Dr. Tracy Kahn, a specialist in citrus at the University of California, Riverside, and she told me that all citrus fruit are derived from four species that originated in Southeast Asia.
Lemons and limes are actually hybrids. So a citron, which is one of the basic species, was at some time crossed with a small-flowered pepita, and that generated what we think of as now small fruited limes, things like the Mexican lime or key lime.
Yes, there is a Mexican lime, but that too came from Asia. They were brought over to Spain during the Crusades and then to South America by the conquistadors, and they took hold. Today, it'd be hard to imagine guacamole or tacos or Corona without lime. Still, historically, all these citrus varieties weren't sold in the same place, so you didn't need different words. Today, you do. When Spanish speakers go to the grocery store, there are a host of citrus options and American-based brands that boast lima limón flavors. So, it seems more and more speakers are shifting to lima. There's even a song about limas y limones that is popular in Mexico. For the world, I'm Maura Lavelle.
Later in the show, how animator Sanjay Patel turned the Saturday morning cartoons he grew up on into Pixar gold. Stick around here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Pixar's Sanjay Patel talks about his family, animation, and big screen diversity.
You know, I think as an immigrant, you just kind of grow up in this way where you don't see many depictions of your family, and so you just kind of get this subconscious kind of message that your stories don't matter.
Sanjay's super team to the rescue, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Negotiators at the Global Climate Summit in Paris have been told to step on it. Today, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius told them, "We must accelerate the process because there is still a lot of work to do." Urgent, a pedal to the metal metaphors aside, 195 nations have reps in Paris to hammer out a deal on climate change, and they've got to finish the job by December 11th. Last time around, 2009, in Copenhagen, China was seen as the obstructor. 6 years ago, it didn't want to commit to reducing its reliance on coal to power its fast-growing economy. But today, China announced plans to make big cuts in coal pollution by 2020. The World's Mary Kay Magsad covered China for many years. Tell us more about today's announcement, Mary Kay, by China, and what it actually means.
Well, this is a continuation of a series of pledges that China has made. It started with saying that China will cap its absolute use of coal by 2030. In other words, it's not just saying that it will reduce the rate of growth of coal, it will cap the total use of coal by 2030. And many people expect that to happen a lot sooner than 2030. In fact, last year, coal use was actually down a bit. Some people think that was because economic growth had slowed. But also, China's been moving toward embracing renewable energy, finding ways to use coal more efficiently. using natural gas more, et cetera, and of course nuclear energy as well.
Yeah, what has happened in the last 6 years to change that position? Because it certainly wasn't their tone back in 2009 in Copenhagen.
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, when I was the world's correspondent in China in 2009, I talked to several Chinese officials and people from think tanks who all were speaking with one voice and saying, look, you people in the West had 100, 150 years of dirty development, and you became rich by doing that. Now it's our turn. They're not saying that anymore. One of the reasons is China reached and surpassed the rate of emissions that the United States had much sooner than expected. They thought that they'd have another decade or even more to be able to continue their path of dirty development. And halfway through the first decade of the 2000s, they already surpassed the U.S. At the same time, pollution was getting worse within China, and the Chinese population was starting to push back hard. At this point, something like 1.6 million Chinese die prematurely each year due to causes related to air pollution. The cost has become too high for the government, both in terms of looking at the cost of human life, but also recognizing that climate change actually affects China as much or more than it affects any other place on Earth. China's temperature across the country has been rising faster on average than the global average. Chinese are looking at, oh, okay, so this is actually affecting how much flooding we get, how much drought we get, how much precipitation we get to grow crops. This could affect whether we can be food self-sufficient. This could affect Chinese coastal cities. This is a big deal for us.
This news today from Beijing does feel kind of like China has come inside the tent. And now it's over to India, another big CO2 emitter with a growing economy that does not want to commit real wholeheartedly to overall emissions cuts. 6 years ago, China and India were on the same side. What's the relationship on this today?
Right. So, I mean, it's very different, the point that China's at in its economic development and the point that India's at. India's per capita CO2 emissions are a tiny fraction of China's and of the United States. 300 million Indians don't even have electricity. So the Indian government is looking at that and saying, you know, realistically speaking, we're going to have to use more energy to be able to help our economy grow. But what India has pledged to do is to try to focus on finding more energy efficient ways to develop, and has also committed to trying to adopt a lot more solar energy earlier on than China did. Now, a way that China could help India and other developing countries who are at these early stages of development, relatively early stages, is that China's kind of learned along the way, and it has been investing heavily in its own renewable energy sector and driving down costs on solar and wind energy, and also actually on making coal power plants more efficient. I mean, if you're going to use coal in the most efficient way possible. Burn as little as you can. China also has technology that helps developing countries make steel and other inputs for development more efficiently using less energy than China did in its early stages of development.
All right, so quick sum up. I think the answers will be pretty short here. Do you think China will deliver on its promised emissions cuts? And will other developing countries end up following China's example?
Hard to predict the future, but the way that things have been going in the recent past, it suggests that China is serious about delivering. And it does look like China has a lot to offer other developing countries so that they can avoid the kind of dirty development that China had early in its path to development.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess one thing that we should always point out with China, Mary Kay, is that if this decision goes through, it will be done by the authorities, not by some democratic vote.
Well, that's true. But as more than one person in China and even in the United States has pointed out, and certainly also I've heard this in India, when you've got an authoritarian government, sometimes it's easier to push through policy changes that, you know, could make those in industry and in business suffer a little bit. President Obama may have a harder time pushing through some of the changes he'd like to see in the United States through the U.S. Congress than Xi Jinping is going to have in China.
The World's Mary Kay Magstad, host of the PRI podcast, Whose Century Is It?, which you can find at PRI.org/century. Mary Kay, always great to speak with you. Thank you.
And with you, Marco. Thanks.
It might be easy to point fingers at China these days as the world's biggest current greenhouse gas polluter, but one of the ways it got to that position is by making products for us here in the West. Now, though, as China starts to ratchet down its carbon emissions, it's also starting to refocus its economy. The world's Jason Margolis gives us a look at what that could mean for the health of the planet.
When economic historians look back on the first 15 years of the 21st century, here's the headline. China built a lot of stuff, and most everyone else bought that stuff. Last August, though, that model looked like it was crashing to a halt.
Chinese shares have continued their sharp fall as concerns over the country's slowing growth.
The fear now is that the boom is over and that China is on the edge of its own crash.
It was stunning and scary to many, but economists who follow China's economic growth weren't caught off guard.
We always knew that was not going to be sustainable for the very long term.
Robert Kahn is with the Council on Foreign Relations. China's economy had been growing by 10, 12, even 14% in recent years. Over the next few years, Kahn expects China to grow at closer to 5 or 6% annually.
Now, to you and me, that's still a very good number.
And many environmentalists say it's also a better number for the planet. Jamie Plotnick is with the Carbon Trust, a London-based organization that helps governments and businesses transition to a low-carbon economy.
The take-make-waste model that we have at the moment in our economy, you manufacture something, you throw it away in landfill, it's not going to be what's going to work for the rest of this century. It can't do because we're running out of resources and it will result in dangerous climate change.
Climate change has also been made more dangerous by how China builds things for the rest of the world. Laura Diaz-Anadon at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government recently quantified the environmental costs, the carbon dioxide emissions, in manufacturing 15 products in China.
And what we show, the difference between making them in Europe and China is large. So on average, emissions per unit mass of each product are 4.4 times greater in China than if you make them in the EU.
There are a few key reasons for this. The first one, China relies heavily on coal as its primary energy source, which produces a lot of greenhouse gases.
The second one is that China tends to use equipment that is less efficient.
Now, it would be easy for an environmentalist at this point to say, okay, I'll just buy less stuff made in China. Easier said than done. Consider your refrigerator. There's a lot of parts making it go. Anadon's research focuses on the parts inside, made from copper, steel, and iron, the early part of the supply chain.
In terms of the consumer, I think it is actually quite hard to know what you should buy. If you were able to find out this is made from copper made in China or something like this, then you would know that this product has a component that has a very high carbon intensity.
It's an incredibly difficult question for most consumers.
That's Jamie Plotnick again with the Carbon Trust. He says consumers can minimize their carbon footprint by doing things like buying a smaller car rather than an SUV. But with most products, it's really up to manufacturers to build smarter.
And that might involve, for example, a more circular approach to manufacturing where companies will design products that are supposed to be remanufactured. You're already seeing this now where companies, particularly in the automotive industry, are looking at remanufacturing engines and gearboxes. Then you don't need to extract the same metals again. You can extract the economic value from that waste. So actually it can be better for those companies.
Besides manufacturing smarter, China may also be moving toward manufacturing less. Robert Kahn says China has been transitioning to a different type of economy.
That transition, or what we've been calling a rebalancing, meant shifting away from a manufacturing-driven model to one that was more consumer-based, more oriented towards retail and financial services and the like.
Kahn says this transition should take 5 to 7 years and will reverberate to countries that supply China's raw materials, places like Brazil and Australia. The climate crisis is also forcing these countries to rethink how their economies grow. Add it all up, and the headlines about the next phase of globalization could read very differently. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Our next story takes us to a place we don't often visit on The World, New Zealand. Politics there are in a kind of uproar right now. The country's prime minister, John Key, is in his third term, but recently faced an outright rebellion from women in parliament. From Dunedin, Carla Green has our story.
Many female politicians in New Zealand say they've just about had it. About 2 years ago, a big story broke here. Several girls had gone to the police, saying a group of teenage boys had gotten them drunk, raped them, and then bragged about it on Facebook. To the public's outrage, the boys were never charged. And at one point, in response to the story, Prime Minister Key said, quote, "These young guys should just grow up," unquote. It didn't go over well. he was eviscerated online for making light of the accusations. Madama Davidson is a member of parliament with the Green Party. She's one of 40 female MPs, many of whom say they're fed up with Key.
He himself has been an example of the sexism that exists in our culture. And it was, you know, we'd had enough. As women, we'd had enough.
And then recently, this happened.
And dispatched to New Zealand. Will you back the rapists?
Order!
It was part of a debate in Parliament about New Zealand citizens detained in Australia, a long simmering backstory too complicated to go into. The point is, female MPs felt like the Prime Minister was making light of rape yet again, while also accusing them of somehow supporting it. They asked Key to apologize.
And I've determined that the House should not be offended at that.
But the Speaker wouldn't ask Key to apologize, although lawmakers say apologies are fairly common in Parliament. So a whole group of opposition lawmakers walked out in protest. Then about a dozen female MPs decided to take it a step further. They wanted to make the point that rape can't be used to score political points. They decided to tell their own stories on the parliamentary floor.
Point of order, Madama Davidson.
As a victim order of sexual violence...
The member will leave the chamber.
In total, about 12 women tried to speak out. First, the Speaker of the House ruled the women out of order and told them to sit down. But as the declarations kept coming, the Speaker started to kick out the female MPs who tried to speak, one by one. The rest walked out in solidarity. For many of these women, this was the first time they'd spoken publicly about being sexually violated. Green Party co-leader Mitiria Ture spoke about being sexually assaulted in a taxi when she was a teen.
At some point, we have to stop, particularly men, from having such a blasé attitude towards sexual assault. We just have to.
The female MPs say they're far from the first New Zealand women to be silenced or ignored when coming forward about sexual violence. They say police and other authorities often dismiss or ridicule women who report being sexually assaulted. And it's worse for Maori girls and women. Ministry of Justice data show they're almost twice as likely as white women to be sexually assaulted at some point in their lives. But under the Key administration, funding has been cut for the very organizations that support victims of sexual violence. Clarissa Newdorf works for one of those organizations, a survivor support service in the South Island of New Zealand. She says she's worried about the message New Zealand women will take away from the episode in Parliament this month.
It might make it more visible about how common rape and sexual abuse are and how many people it does affect. I think that's really positive. But then the issue was that they were silenced. And so I think that's sending a very strong message as well. And so that could also make more women worried about disclosing.
Still, the female MPs say staying quiet wasn't an option.
We can't tackle it if it stays in the dark. And that's just the awful truth of it.
That awful truth, Mitiria Ture says, means lawmakers like her will have to be the first to speak out about sexual violence. She and other female MPs hope that will finally spur a conversation New Zealand has been reluctant to have. For The World, I'm Carla Green in Dunedin, New Zealand.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Back in the day, I loved going to the movies because the animated shorts were often as good as the feature film. That's the case with Pixar's latest short, Sanjay's Super Team. In Sanjay's Super Team, a young boy is watching cartoons, the volume turned way up. His father is in the same room, trying to perform a Hindu ceremony. Dad is not happy, and a battle over the volume and remote ensues. Ultimately, the father wins. Okay, let's say it's win-win. Pixar's Sanjay Patel is the man behind this new short film. We had him on the show a while back to talk about his illustrated guide to Hindu deities. Patel says the volume battle scene is a page from his own life.
Every morning, between like 8 o'clock in the morning, my dad would wake up and he would start a puja and an aarti. These are two. The puja is a flower ceremony and an aarti is a fire ceremony in the Hindu sort of practice. And every morning he would kind of do all this prep work, you know, picking flowers, painting anointing the deities, lighting all these candles. And then he would ring this bell, this prayer bell. And the second that bell would ring, that would be the signal for me to turn off the TV and to come over and join him. And of course, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, I'd be sitting right beside him because we lived in a very small room in San Bernardino and the TV was right next to a shrine. And so I'd just be kind of worshiping my gods on the TV, which were the superheroes. And, you know, the comedy was that, well, not the comedy, but the pain was that he would be worshiping his deities right beside me. And unfortunately, you know, it meant that I'd have to turn off the TV and sit next to my dad. And that was really hard for me when I was growing up.
I wonder if that tension is still happening to a certain degree.
Oh, you know, at some point, I think it was like during middle school or high school, like my brother Amul finally told my dad, that's enough, I've had it. And, you know, and then my dad didn't call us anymore. And we weren't able to talk to him then about how he felt about that. But, you know, of course, for me and my brother, we were like thrilled because then we could just keep watching our shows. But
have you come to an understanding with your father, though, about, you know, your observance of religion in one way or another?
Oh, absolutely. It took like 35 years for me to like finally illustrate these books and then to sort of make this film. And I think bit by bit, my father really did understand that, you know, he's faithful by sitting on his mat and worshiping his deities. You know, and I told my dad that it's like I'm just as reverent. It's just I sit at a Herman Miller chair looking at a Macintosh computer, illustrating the deities and retelling their stories. We're both devoted. We're just practicing it in a different way.
I got to say, having read your book, The Little Book of Hindu Deities, this short also seems to fit in with your desire to introduce the myriad Hindu deities to a wider audience.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't think that was what I was heading toward. You know, you know, it's really cool. John Lasseter was the one who really gave me permission to sort of tell my story, to tell the story of me and my dad.
Honestly, and John is a big wheel at Pixar?
Yeah, I mean, he's a creative director here. I mean, it's his shop. And I just can't tell you what it meant to get his permission and his blessing to tell that story. So I just couldn't be more happy about that.
I heard this was Pixar's first animation, long feature or short, with a protagonist who is from the Asian subcontinent, a dark brown man. Is that true?
I think so, yeah.
So you work at Pixar. Had you or others been lobbying for this from inside the company? And what did you notice about the faces of Pixar characters?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody had lobbied for it, no. I mean, you know, for me, the thing I was always wanting, you know, I guess I didn't realize it, you know, but as I just kind of got older and more mature, I think just subconsciously, I just didn't see many depictions of people like me or my family or people from my community that wasn't the kind of the butt of the joke. And so in some ways, you know, I definitely felt this pang of like wanting to see, you know, kind of a more nuanced and, I don't know, sensitive portrayal of people from my community. And when I had the opportunity to sort of have a protagonist that looked like somebody from my family, I just felt like, wow, this could be a game changer in terms, you know, it could really turn the culture needle just a tiny tick, you know, and I think that would be a big deal for my nieces and nephews and for other kids, you know, around the world to see, I don't know, a different face of Pixar. I think that's really cool, man.
And I'm curious to know how your father feels about the short. Has he seen it?
It was pretty surreal, Marco, I got to say. So everybody at Pixar was really excited because they knew what a personal story this was. And so they were always really curious. They're like, oh, dude, what does your dad think of this? And oh, man, it was tough because I had to tell them the story, which was like, you know, my dad hadn't seen a movie since we left the UK, which was like 35 years ago. I finally asked my dad, I'm like, Dad, what was the last movie you saw? And he was like, something with Julie Andrews. And it turned out it was like The Sound of Music. And so my dad hadn't been to a movie theater in decades. And then on top of that, he's never seen any of the Pixar movies. He's never seen any of the Pixar movies that I've worked on. He's never seen computer animation. And so it was pretty surreal to like ask him to come to the studio and to check out this film about me and his history. And, you know, and he watched it and, you know, he really broke down and he really was so proud and he was really emotional and it was really beautiful. I mean, he just turned to me and he reflected back to me what he felt the short was about. He's like, it's about a father and son. They look into each other's eyes and they figure out a way to compromise. And I just thought that was beautiful.
Sanjay Patel is the director of Pixar's new animated short, Sanjay Super Team. It's in theaters now, airing before The Good Dinosaur, just like back in the old days, a short and then the feature. Sanjay, good to speak with you again, man.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Marco.
And finally today, imagine Roald Dahl and Dr. Seuss put together. That's how a recent tweet referred to Japanese graphic artist Shigeru Mizuki. He died on Monday at the age of 93. Sensei Mizuki, as some called him, since he was a master of his craft. Some say he invented manga, the rapidly drawn serialized cartoons that became popular after World War II. I met Mizuki in Tokyo in 2011. At the time, the first ever English translation of his World War II story, Onward Towards Our Noble Deaths, had just been published. The book was based on his experiences fighting one especially savage battle in Papua New Guinea. Mizuki had told me that the dialogue contains the same jokes the soldiers told to each other. Mizuki tells me that he only wrote what actually happened. All the conversations in the book, he says, they did take place. It was so boring digging trenches, so we had to have a laugh. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made it. Every single day, it was just digging trenches. That was from my 2011 interview with Mizuki in his home on the outskirts of Tokyo. I remember that many of his neighbors had decorated their homes and storefronts with little sculptures of some of his beloved cartoon characters. He was a remarkable man. You can hear and see more of my 2011 conversation with Shigeru Mizuki. The video is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/PRI the world. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.